Neuromancer by William Gibson, continued. Cassette 2, Side 2. Case wondered what the moderns had done to provoke that level of terror. He knew it had something to do with a hoaxed threat, but he'd been too involved with his ice to follow Molly's explanation. "That's it," Case said, but she'd already stopped in front of the cabinet that held the construct. Its lines reminded Case of the Neo-Aztec bookcases in Julie Dean's anteroom in Chiba. "Do it, Cutter," Molly said. Case flipped to cyberspace and sent a command pulsing down the crimson thread that pierced the library ice. 5 separate alarm systems were convinced that they were still operative. The 3 elaborate locks deactivated, but considered themselves to have remained locked. The library's central bank suffered a minute shift in its permanent memory. The construct had been removed, per executive order, a month before. Checking for the authorization to remove the construct, a librarian would find the records erased. The door swung open on silent hinges. 0467839, Case said, and Molly drew a black storage unit from the rack. It resembled the magazine of a large assault rifle, its surfaces covered with warning decals and security ratings. Molly closed the locker door. Case flipped. He withdrew the line through the library ice. It whipped back into his program, automatically triggering a full system reversal. The SenseNet gates snapped past him as he backed out, subprograms whirling back into the core of the icebreaker as he passed the gates where they had been stationed. "Out, Brood," he said, and slumped in his chair. After the concentration of an actual run, he could remain jacked in and still retain awareness of his body. It might take SenseNet days to discover the theft of the construct. The key would be the deflection of the Los Angeles transfer, which coincided too neatly with the moderns' terror run. He doubted that the 3 security men Molly had encountered in the corridor would live to talk about it. He flipped. The elevator, with Molly's black box taped beside the control panel, remained where she'd left it. The guard still lay curled on the floor. Case noticed the derm on his neck for the first time. Something of Molly's to keep him under. She stepped over him and removed the black box before punching lobby. As the elevator door hissed open, a woman hurtled backward out of the crowd, into the elevator, and struck the rear wall with her head. Molly ignored her, bending over to peel the derm from the guard's neck. Then she kicked the white pants and the pink raincoat out the door, tossing the dark glasses after them, and drew the hood of her suit down across her forehead. The construct in the suit's kangaroo pocket dug into her sternum when she moved. She stepped out. Case had seen panic before, but never in an enclosed area. The SenseNet employees, spilling out of the elevators, had surged for the street doors, only to meet the foam barricades of the tacticals and the sandbag guns of the Bama Rapids. The 2 agencies, convinced that they were containing a horde of potential killers, were cooperating with an uncharacteristic degree of efficiency. Beyond the shattered wreckage of the main street doors, bodies were piled 3 deep on the barricades. The hollow thumping of the riot guns provided a constant background for the sound the crowd made as it surged back and forth across the lobby's marble floor. Case had never heard anything like that sound. Neither, apparently, had Molly. "Jesus," she said, and hesitated. It was a sort of keening, rising into a bubbling wail of raw and total fear. The lobby floor was covered with bodies, clothing, blood, and long trampled scrolls of yellow printout. "Come on, sister, we're for out." The eyes of the 2 moderns stared out of madly swirling shades of polycarbon, their suits unable to keep up with the confusion of shape and color that raged behind them. "You hurt? Come on, Tommy'll walk you." Tommy handed something to the one who spoke, a video camera wrapped in polycarbon. "Chicago," she said. "I'm on my way." And then she was falling, not to the marble floor, slick with blood and vomit, but down some blood-warm well, into silence and the dark. The Panther Modern leader, who introduced himself as Lupus Yonder Boy, wore a polycarbon suit with a recording feature that allowed him to replay backgrounds at will. Perched on the edge of Case's work table like some kind of state-of-the-art gargoyle, he regarded Case and Armitage with hooded eyes. He smiled. His hair was pink. A rainbow forest of Microsofts bristled behind his left ear. The ear was pointed, tufted with more pink hair. His pupils had been modified to catch the light like a cat's. Case watched the suit crawl with color and texture. "You let it get out of control," Armitage said. He stood in the center of the loft like a statue, wrapped in the dark, glossy folds of an expensive-looking trench coat.
"Chaos, Mr. Who," Lupus Yonder Boy said. "That is our mode and modus. That is our central kick. Your woman knows. We deal with her, not with you, Mr. Who."
His suit had taken on a weird, angular pattern of beige and pale avocado.
"She needed her medical team. She's with them. We'll watch out for her. Everything's fine."
He smiled again. "Pay him," Case said. Armitage glared at him.
"We don't have the goods." "Your woman has it," Yonder Boy said.
"Pay him." Armitage crossed stiffly to the table and took 3 fat bundles of new yen from the pockets of his trench coat. "You want to count it?" he asked Yonder Boy.
"No," the Panther Modern said. "You'll pay. You're a Mr. Who. You pay to stay one, not a Mr. Name."
"I hope that isn't a threat," Armitage said.
"That's business," said Yonder Boy, stuffing the money into the single pocket on the front of his suit.
The phone rang. Case answered. "Molly," he told Armitage, handing him the phone. The Sprawl's geodesics were lightening into pre-dawn gray as Case left the building. His limbs felt cold and disconnected. He couldn't sleep. He was sick of the loft. Lupus had gone, then Armitage, and Molly was in surgery somewhere. Vibration beneath his feet as a train hissed past, sirens dopplered in the distance. He took corners at random, his collar up, hunched in a new leather jacket, flicking the first of a chain of Yehayuans into the gutter and lighting another. He tried to imagine Armitage's toxin sacs dissolving in his bloodstream, microscopic membranes wearing thinner as he walked. It didn't seem real. Neither did the fear and agony he'd seen through Molly's eyes in the lobby of SenseNet. He found himself trying to remember the faces of the 3 people he'd killed in Chiba. The men were blanks. The woman reminded him of Linda Lee. A battered tricycle truck with mirrored windows bounced past him, empty plastic cylinders rattling in its bed.
"Case!"
He darted sideways, instinctively getting a wall behind his back.
"Message for you, Case."
Lupus Yonder Boy's suit cycled through pure primaries.
"Pardon, not to startle you."
Case straightened up, hands in jacket pockets. He was a head taller than the Modern. "You ought to be careful, Yonder Boy."
"This is the message. Wintermute."
He spelled it out. "From you?" Case took a step forward.
"No," Yonder Boy said. "For you."
"Who from?"
"Wintermute,"
Yonder Boy repeated, nodding, bobbing his crest of pink hair. His suit went matte black, a carbon shadow against old concrete. He executed a strange little dance, his thin black arms whirling, and then he was gone.
"No, there."
Hood up to hide the pink, the suit exactly the right shade of gray, mottled and stained as the sidewalk he stood on. The eyes winked back the red of a stoplight. And then he was really gone. Case closed his eyes, massaged them with numb fingers, leaning back against peeling brickwork. Ninsei had been a lot simpler. Chapter 5. The medical team Molly employed occupied 2 floors of an anonymous condo rack near the old hub of Baltimore. The building was modular, like some giant version of cheap hotel, each coffin 40 meters long. Case met Molly as she emerged from one that wore the elaborately worked logo of one Gerald Chin, dentist. She was limping.
"He says if I kick anything, it'll fall off."
"I ran into one of your pals," he said. "A Modern."
"Yeah? Which one?"
"Lupus Yonder Boy. Had a message." He passed her a paper napkin with Wintermute printed in red felt pen in his neat, laborious capitals. "He said..." But her hand came up in the jive for silence.
"Get us some crab," she said.
After lunch in Baltimore, Molly dissecting her crab with alarming ease, they tubed into New York. Case had learned not to ask questions. They only brought the sign for silence. Her leg seemed to be bothering her, and she seldom spoke. A thin black child with wooden beads and antique resistors woven tightly into her hair opened the Finn's door and led them along the tunnel of refuse. Case felt the stuff had grown somehow during their absence, or else it seemed that it was changing subtly, cooking itself down under the pressure of time. Silent, invisible flakes settling to form a mulch, a crystalline essence of discarded technology, flowering secretly in the sprawl's waste places. Beyond the army blanket, the Finn waited at the white table. Molly began to sign rapidly, produced a scrap of paper, wrote something on it, and passed it to the Finn. He took it between thumb and forefinger, holding it away from his body as though it might explode. He made a sign Case didn't know, one that conveyed a mixture of impatience and glum resignation. He stood up, brushing crumbs from the front of his battered tweed jacket. A glass jar of pickled herring stood on the table, beside a torn plastic package of flatbread and a tin ashtray piled with the butts of partagas. "Wait," the Finn said, and left the room. Molly took his place, extruded the blade from her index finger, and speared a grayish slab of herring. Case wandered aimlessly around the room, fingering the scanning gear on the pylons as he passed. 10 minutes, and the Finn came bustling back, showing his teeth in a wide yellow smile. He nodded, gave Molly a thumbs-up salute, and gestured to Case to help him with the door panel. While Case smoothed the Velcro border into place, the Finn took a flat little console from his pocket and punched out an elaborate sequence. "Honey," he said to Molly, tucking the console away, "you have got it. No shit. I can smell it. You want to tell me where you got it?" "Yonder boy," Molly said, shoving the herring and crackers aside. "I did a deal with Larry on the side."
"Smart," the Finn said. "It's an AI.
"Slow it down a little," Case said.
"Bairn,"
the Finn said, ignoring him.
"Bairn. It's got limited Swiss citizenship under their equivalent of the Act of 53. Built for Tessier Ashpool S.A. They own the mainframe and the original software."
"What's in Bairn, okay?" Case deliberately stepped between them.
"Wintermute is the recognition code for an AI. I've got the Turing registry numbers. Artificial intelligence."
"Oh, that's all just fine," Molly said. "But where's it get us?"
"If yonder boy's right," the Finn said, "this AI is backing Armitage."
"I paid Larry to have the moderns nose around Armitage a little," Molly explained, turning to Case. "They have some very weird lines of communication. Deal was, they'd get my money if they answered one question. Who's running Armitage?"
"And you think it's this AI? Those things aren't allowed any autonomy. It'll be the parent corporation, this Tessier Ashpool S.A., said the Finn. "And I got a little story for you about them. Want to hear?"
He sat down and hunched forward.
"Finn," Molly said, "he loves a story."
"Haven't ever told anybody this one," the Finn began.
The Finn was a fence, a trafficker in stolen goods, primarily in software. In the course of his business, he sometimes came into contact with other fences, some of whom dealt in the more traditional articles of the trade. In precious metals, stamps, rare coins, gems, jewelry, furs, and paintings and other works of art. The story he told Case and Molly began with another man's story, a man he called Smith. Smith was also a fence, but in balmier seasons he surfaced as an art dealer. He was the first person the Finn had known who'd gone silicon. The phrase had an old-fashioned ring for Case, and the Microsofts he purchased were art history programs and tables of gallery sales. With half a dozen chips in his new socket, Smith's knowledge of the art business was formidable, at least by the standards of his colleagues. But Smith had come to the Finn with a request for help, a fraternal request, one businessman to another. He wanted a go-to on the Tessier Ashpool clan, he said, and it had to be executed in a way that would guarantee the impossibility of the subject ever tracing the inquiry to its source. It might be possible, the Finhead opined, but an explanation was definitely required.
It smelled, the Finn said to Case. Smelled of money. And Smith was being very careful, almost too careful.
Smith, it developed, had had a supplier known as Jimmy. Jimmy was a burglar and other things as well, and just back from a year in high orbit, having carried certain things back down the gravity well. The most unusual thing Jimmy had managed to score on his swing through the archipelago was a head, an intricately worked bust, cloisonné over platinum, studded with seed pearls and lapis. Smith, sighing, had put down his pocket microscope and advised Jimmy to melt the thing down. It was contemporary, not an antique, and had no value to the collector. Jimmy laughed. The thing was a computer terminal, he said. It could talk, and not in a synth voice, but with a beautiful arrangement of gears and miniature organ pipes. It was a Baroque thing for anyone to have constructed, a perverse thing, because synth voice chips cost next to nothing. It was a curiosity. Smith jacked the head into his computer and listened as the melodious, inhuman voice piped the figures of last year's tax return. Smith's clientele included a Tokyo billionaire whose passion for clockwork automata approached fetishism. Smith shrugged, showing Jimmy his upturned palms in a gesture old as pawn shops. He could try, he said, but he doubted he could get much for it. When Jimmy had gone, leaving the head, Smith went over it carefully, discovering certain hallmarks. Eventually, he'd been able to trace it to an unlikely collaboration between two Zurich artisans, an enamel specialist in SS, a Dutch jeweler, and a California chip designer. It had been commissioned, he discovered, by Tessier Ashpool, S.A. Smith began to make preliminary passes at the Tokyo collector, hinting that he was on the track of something noteworthy. And then he had a visitor unannounced, one who walked in through the elaborate maze of Smith's security as though it didn't exist. A small man, Japanese, enormously polite, who bore all the marks of a vat-grown ninja assassin. Smith sat very still, staring into the calm brown eyes of death across a polished table of Vietnamese rosewood. Gently, almost apologetically, the cloned killer explained that it was his duty to find and return a certain artwork, a mechanism of great beauty, which had been taken from the house of his master. It had come to his attention, the ninja said, that Smith might know of the whereabouts of this object. Smith told the man that he had no wish to die, and produced the head. And how much, his visitor asked, did you expect to obtain through the sale of this object? Smith named a figure far lower than the price he'd intended to set. The ninja produced a credit chip and keyed Smith that amount out of a numbered Swiss account. And who, the man asked, brought you this piece? Smith told him. Within days, Smith learned of Jimmy's death.
So that was where I came in, the Finn continued. Smith knew I dealt a lot with the Memory Lane crowd, and that's where you go for a quiet go-to that'll never be traced. I hired a cowboy. I was the cutout, so I took a percentage. Smith, he was careful. He just had a very weird business experience, and he'd come out on top, but it didn't add up. Who'd paid out of that Swiss stash? Yakuza? No way. They got a very rigid code, covers situations like that, and they kill the receiver, too, always. Was it spook stuff? Smith didn't think so. Spook biz has a vibe. You get so you can smell it. Well, I had my cowboy buzz the news morgues until we found Tessier Ashpool in litigation. The case wasn't anything, but we got the law firm. Then he did the lawyer's ice, and we got the family address. A lot of good it did us.
Case raised his eyebrows.
Freeside, the Finn said. The spindle. Turns out they owned damn near the whole thing. The interesting stuff was the picture we got when the cowboy ran a regular go-to on the news morgues and compiled a précis. Family organization. Corporate structure. Supposedly you can buy into an SA, but there hasn't been a share of Tessier Ashpool traded on the open market in over 100 years. On any market, as far as I know. You're looking at a very quiet, very eccentric, first-generation, high-orbit family, run like a corporation. Big money.
very shy of media. Lot of cloning. Orbital law is a lot softer on genetic engineering, right? And it's hard to keep track of which generation, or combination of generations, is running the show at a given time.
How's that? Molly asked.
Got their own cryogenic setup. Even under orbital law, you're legally dead for the duration of a freeze. Looks like they trade off, though nobody's seen the Founding Father in about 30 years. Founding Mama? She died in some lab accident.
So, what happened with your fence?
Nothing.
The Finn frowned.
Dropped it. We had a look at this fantastic tangle of powers of attorney the TAs have, and that was it. Jimmy must have gotten into stray light, lifted the head, and Tessier Ashpool sent their ninja after it. Smith decided to forget about it. Maybe he was smart.
He looked at Molly.
The Villa Stray Light, tip of the spindle, strictly private.
You figure they own that ninja, Finn? Molly asked.
Smith thought so.
Expensive, she said. Wonder whatever happened to that little ninja, Finn.
Probably got him on ice. Thaw when needed.
Okay, Case said. We got Armitage getting his goodies off an AI named Wintermute. Where's that get us?
Nowhere yet, Molly said. But you got a little side gig now.
She drew a folded scrap of paper from her pocket and handed it to him. He opened it. Grid coordinates and entry codes.
Who's this?
Armitage. Some database of his. Bought it from the moderns. Separate deal.
Where is it?
London, Case said.
Crack it.
She laughed. Earn your keep for a change. Case waited for a Trans-Bama local on the crowded platform. Molly had gone back to the loft hours ago, the Flatline's construct in her green bag, and Case had been drinking steadily ever since. It was disturbing to think of the Flatline as a construct, a hardwired ROM cassette replicating a dead man's skills, obsessions, knee-jerk responses. The local came booming in along the black induction strip, fine grit sifting from cracks in the tunnel's ceiling. Case shuffled into the nearest door and watched the other passengers as he rode. A pair of predatory-looking Christian scientists were edging toward a trio of young office techs who wore idealized holographic vaginas on their wrists, wet pink glittering under the harsh lighting. The techs licked their perfect lips nervously and eyed the Christian scientists from beneath lowered metallic lids. The girls looked like tall, exotic, grazing animals, swaying gracefully and unconsciously with the movement of the train, their high heels like polished hooves against the gray metal of the car's floor. Before they could stampede, take flight from the missionaries, the train reached Case's station. He stepped out and caught sight of a white holographic cigar suspended against the wall of the station. Freeside, pulsing beneath it in contorted capitals that mimicked printed Japanese. He walked through the crowd and stood beneath it, studying the thing.
Why wait? Pulsed the sign.
A blunt white spindle, flanged and studded with grids and radiators, docks, domes. He'd seen the ad, or others like it, thousands of times. It had never appealed to him. With his deck, he could reach the Freeside banks as easily as he could reach Atlanta. Travel was a meat thing. But now he noticed the little sigil, the size of a small coin, woven into the lower left corner of the ad's fabric of light. T.A. He walked back to the loft, lost in memories of the Flatline. He'd spent most of his 19th summer in the Gentleman Loser, nursing expensive beers and watching the Cowboys. He'd never touched a deck then, but he knew what he wanted. There were at least 20 other hopefuls ghosting the loser that summer, each one bent on working Joe Boy for some cowboy. No other way to learn. They'd all heard of Polly, the redneck jockey from the Lanta fringes, who'd survived brain death behind black ice. The Grapevine, slender, street-level, and the only one going, had little to say about Polly, other than that he'd done the impossible. It was big, another would-be told Case, for the price of a beer. But who knows what? I hear maybe a Brazilian payroll net. Anyway, the man was dead, flat down brain death. Case stared across the crowded bar at a thick-set man in shirt sleeves, something leaden about the shade of his skin.
Boy, the Flatline would tell him months later in Miami.
I'm like them huge fucking lizards, you know? Had themselves two goddamn brains, one in the head and one by the tailbone. Kept the hind legs moving. Hit that black stuff and old tail brain just kept right on keeping on.
The cowboy elite in The Loser shunned Pauly out of some strange group anxiety, almost a superstition. McCoy Pauly, Lazarus of cyberspace. And his heart had done for him in the end. His surplus Russian heart, implanted in a POW camp during the war. He'd refused to replace the thing, saying he needed its particular beat to maintain his sense of timing. Case fingered the slip of paper Molly had given him and made his way up the stairs. Molly was snoring on the temper foam. A transparent cast ran from her knee to a few millimeters below her crotch, the skin beneath the rigid micropore mottled with bruises, the black shading into ugly yellow. 8 derms, each a different size and color, ran in a neat line down her left wrist. An Akai transdermal unit lay beside her, its fine red leads connected to input trodes under the cast. He turned on the tensor beside the Hosaka. The crisp circle of light fell directly on the flatline's construct. He slotted some ice, connected the construct, and jacked in. It was exactly the sensation of someone reading over his shoulder. He coughed. "Dix? McCoy? That you, man?" His throat was tight.
"Hey, bro," said a directionless voice.
"It's Case, man, remember?"
"Miami, Joe boy. Quick study."
"What's the last thing you remember before I spoke to you, Dix?"
"Nothing."
"Hang on." He disconnected the construct. The press was gone. He reconnected it.
"Dix, who am I?"
"You got me hung, Jack. Who the fuck are you?"
"Kate, your buddy, partner. What's happening, man?"
"Good question."
"Remember being here a second ago?"
"No."
"Know how a ROM personality matrix works?"
"Sure, bro. It's a firmware construct."
"So I jack it into the bank I'm using. I can give it sequential real-time memory?"
"Guess so," said the construct.
"Okay, Dix. You are a ROM construct. Got me?"
"If you say so," said the construct.
"Who are you?"
"Case."
"Miami," said the voice. "Joe boy, quick study."
"Right. And for starts, Dix, you and me, we're gonna sleaze over to London Grid and access a little data. You game for that?"
"You gonna tell me I got a choice, boy?"
Chapter 6. "You want you a paradise," the flatline advised when Case had explained his situation. "Check Copenhagen, fringes of the university section." The voice recited coordinates as he punched. They found their paradise, a pirate's paradise, on the jumbled border of a low-security academic grid. At first glance, it resembled the kind of graffiti student operators sometimes left at the junctions of grid lines, faint glyphs of colored light that shimmered against the confused outlines of a dozen arts faculties.
"There," said the flatline, "the blue one. Make it out? That's an entry code for Bell Europa. Fresh, too. Bell will get in here soon and read the whole damn board. Change any codes they find posted. Kids will steal the new ones tomorrow."
Case tapped his way into Bell Europa and switched to a standard phone code. With the flatline's help, he connected with the London database that Molly claimed was Armitage's.
"Here," said the voice. "I'll do it for you."
The flatline began to chant a series of digits, Case keying them on his deck, trying to catch the pauses the construct used to indicate timing. It took 3 tries.
"Big deal," said the flatline. "No ice at all."
"Scan this shit," Case told the Hosaka. "Sift for owner's personal history." The neuroelectronic scrawls of the paradise vanished, replaced by a simple lozenge of white light. "Contents are primarily video recordings of post-war military trials," said the distant voice of the Hosaka. "Central figure is Colonel Willis Corto."
"Show it already," Case said.
A man's face filled the screen. The eyes were Armitage's. 2 hours later, Case fell beside Molly on the slab and let the temper foam mold itself against him.
"You find anything?" she asked,
her voice fuzzy with sleep and drugs.
"Tell you later," he said. "I'm wrecked."
He was hungover and confused. He lay there, eyes closed, and tried to sort the various parts of a story about a man called Corto. The Hosaka had sorted a thin store of data and assembled a précis, but it was full of gaps. Some of the material had been print records, reeling smoothly down the screen, too quickly, and Case had had to ask the computer to read them for him. Other segments were audio recordings of the Screaming Fist hearing. Willis Corto, Colonel, had plummeted through a blind spot in the Russian defenses over Kerensk. The shuttles had created the hole with pulse bombs, and Corto's team had dropped in night-wing microlights, their wings snapping taut in moonlight, reflected in jags of silver along the rivers Angara and Podhamanaya, the last light Corto would see for 15 months. Case tried to imagine the microlights blossoming out of their launch capsules, high above a frozen steppe.
"They sure as hell did shaft you, boss," Case said, and Molly stirred beside him.
The microlights had been unarmed, stripped to compensate for the weight of a console operator, a prototype deck, and a virus program called Mole-9, the first true virus in the history of cybernetics. Corto and his team had been training for the run for 3 years. They were through the ice, ready to inject Mole-9, when the EMPs went off. The Russian pulse guns threw the jockeys into electronic darkness. The night wings suffered systems crash, flight circuitry wiped clean. Then the lasers opened up, aiming on infrared, taking out the fragile radar-transparent assault planes, and Corto and his dead console man fell out of a Siberian sky, fell and kept falling. There were gaps in the story here, where Case scanned documents concerning the flight of a commandeered Russian gunship that managed to reach Finland, to be gutted as it landed in a spruce grove by an antique 20-millimeter cannon manned by a cadre of reservists on dawn alert. Screaming Fist had ended for Corto on the outskirts of Helsinki, with Finnish paramedics sawing him out of the twisted belly of the helicopter. The war ended 9 days later, and Corto was shipped to a military facility in Utah, blind, legless, and missing most of his jaw. It took 11 months for the congressional aide to find him there. He listened to the sound of tubes draining. In Washington and McLean, the show trials were already underway. The Pentagon and the CIA were being balkanized, partially dismantled, and a congressional investigation had focused on Screaming Fist. Ripe for watergating, the aide told Corto. He'd need eyes, legs, and extensive cosmetic work, the aide said, but that could be arranged. New plumbing, the man added, squeezing Corto's shoulder through the sweat-damp sheet. Corto heard the soft, relentless dripping. He said he preferred to testify as he was. No, the aide explained. The trials were being televised. The trials needed to reach the voter. The aide coughed politely. Repaired, refurnished, and extensively rehearsed, Corto's subsequent testimony was detailed, moving, lucid, and largely the invention of a congressional cabal with certain vested interests in saving particular portions of the Pentagon infrastructure. Corto gradually understood that the testimony he gave was instrumental in saving the careers of 3 officers directly responsible for the suppression of reports on the building of the EMP installations at Kerensk. His role in the trials over, he was unwanted in Washington. In an M Street restaurant over asparagus crepes, the aide explained the terminal dangers involved in talking to the wrong people. Corto crushed the man's larynx with the rigid fingers of his right hand. The congressional aide strangled, his face in an asparagus crepe, and Corto stepped out into cool Washington September. The Hosaka rattled through police reports, corporate espionage records, and news files. Case watched Corto work corporate defectors in Lisbon and Marrakesh, where he seemed to grow obsessed with the idea of betrayal, to loathe the scientists and technicians he bought out for his employers. Drunk in Singapore, he beat a Russian engineer to death in a hotel and set fire to his room. Next, he surfaced in Thailand as overseer of a heroin factory, then as enforcer for a California gambling cartel, then as a paid killer in the ruins of Bonn. He robbed a bank in Wichita. The record grew vague, shadowy, the gaps longer. One day, he said, in a taped segment that suggested chemical interrogation, everything had gone gray. Translated French medical records explained that a man without identification had been taken to a Paris mental health unit and diagnosed as schizophrenic. He became catatonic and was sent to a government institution on the outskirts of Toulon. He became a subject in an experimental program that sought to reverse schizophrenia through the application of cybernetic models. A random selection of patients were provided with microcomputers and encouraged, with help from students, to program them. He was cured, the only success in the entire experiment. The record ended there. Case turned on the phone and Molly cursed him softly for disturbing her. The telephone rang. He pulled it into bed.
Yeah? We're going to Istanbul, Armitage said. Tonight.
What does that bastard want? Molly asked.
Says we're going to Istanbul tonight.
Oh, that's just wonderful.
Armitage was reading off flight numbers and departure times. Molly sat up and turned on the light.
What about my gear? Case asked. My deck.
Finn will handle it, said Armitage, and hung up.
Case watched her pack. There were dark circles under her eyes, but even with the cast on, it was like watching a dance. No wasted motion. His clothes were a rumpled pile beside his bag.
You hurting? He asked.
I could do with another night at Chin's.
Your dentist?
You betcha. Very discreet. He's got half that rack, full clinic. Does repairs for Samurai. She was zipping her bag.
You ever been to Istanbul?
Couple days, once.
Never changes, she said.
Bad old town.
It was like this when we headed for Chiba, Molly said, staring out the train window at blasted industrial moonscape, red beacons on the horizon warning aircraft away from a fusion plant.
We were in L.A. He came in and said, pack. We were booked for Macau. When we got there, I played Fantan in the Lisboa, and he crossed over into Zhongshan. Next day, I was playing Ghost with you in Night City. She took a silk scarf from the sleeve of her black jacket and polished the insets. The landscape of the northern sprawl woke confused memories of childhood for Case. Dead grass tufting the cracks in a canted slab of freeway concrete. The train began to decelerate 10 kilometers from the airport. Case watched the sunrise on the landscape of childhood, on broken slag and the rusting shells of refineries.
Chapter 7. It was raining in Bayaglu, and the rented Mercedes slid past the grilled and unlit windows of cautious Greek and Armenian jewelers. The street was almost empty, only a few dark-coated figures on the sidewalks turning to stare after the car. This was formerly the prosperous European section of Ottoman Istanbul, purred the Mercedes.
So it's gone downhill, Case said.
The Hiltons in Cumhuriyet Kadesi, Molly said. She settled back against the car's gray ultra-suede.
How come Armitage flies alone? Case asked. He had a headache.
'Cause you get up his nose. You're sure getting up mine.
He wanted to tell her the Quarto story, but decided against it. He'd used a sleep derm on the plane. The road in from the airport had been dead straight, like a neat incision, laying the city open. He'd watched the crazy walls of patchwork wooden tenements slide by. Condos, arcologies, grim housing projects, more walls of plyboard and corrugated iron. The Finn, in a new Shinjuku suit, Sarariman black, was waiting sourly in the Hilton lobby, marooned on a velour armchair in a sea of pale blue carpeting.
Christ, Molly said. Rat in a business suit.
They crossed the lobby.
How much you get paid to come over here, Finn?
She lowered her bag beside the armchair.
Bet not as much as you get for wearing that suit, huh?
The Finn's upper lips drew back.
Not enough, sweetmeat.
He handed her a magnetic key with a round yellow tag.
You're registered already. Honcho's upstairs.
He looked around.
This town sucks.
You get agoraphobic, they take you out from under a dome. Just pretend it's Brooklyn or something. She twirled the key around a finger. You here as valet or what?
I gotta check out some guy's implants, the Finn said.
How about my deck? Case asked.
The Finn winced.
Observe the protocol. Ask the boss.
Molly's fingers moved in the shadow of her jacket, a flicker of jive. The Finn watched, then nodded.
Yeah, she said. I know who that is.
She jerked her head in the direction of the elevators.
Come on, cowboy.
Case followed her with both bags. Their room might have been the one in Chiba where he'd first seen Armitage. He went to the window in the morning, almost expecting to see Tokyo Bay. There was another hotel across the street. It was still raining. A few letter writers had taken refuge in doorways, their old voice printers wrapped in sheets of clear plastic, evidence that the written word still enjoyed a certain prestige here. It was a sluggish country. He watched a dull black Citroën sedan, a primitive hydrogen cell conversion, as it disgorged five sullen-looking Turkish officers in rumpled green uniforms. They entered the hotel across the street. He glanced back at the bed, at Molly, and her paleness struck him. She'd left the micropore cast on the bed slab in their loft, beside the transdermal inducer. Her glasses reflected part of the room's light fixture. He had the phone in his hand before it had a chance to ring twice.
"Glad you're up," Armitage said.
"I'm just. Lady's still under. Listen, boss, I think it's maybe time we have a little talk. I think I work better if I know a little more about what I'm doing."
Silence on the line. Case bit his lip.
"You know as much as you need to. Maybe more."
You think so?
Get dressed, Case. Get her up. You'll have a caller in about 15 minutes. His name is Trezibastian.
The phone bleated softly. Armitage was gone.
Wake up, baby, Case said.
Biz.
I've been awake an hour already.
The mirrors turned.
We got a Jersey Bastion coming up.
You got an ear for language, Case. Bet you're part Armenian. That's the eye Armitage has had on Riviera. Help me up.
Trezibastian proved to be a young man in a gray suit and gold-framed mirrored glasses. His white shirt was open at the collar, revealing a mat of dark hair so dense that Case, at first, mistook it for some kind of T-shirt. He arrived with a black Hilton tray arranged with three tiny, fragrant cups of thick black coffee and three sticky, straw-colored Oriental sweets.
We must, as you say in English, take this one very easy.
He seemed to stare pointedly at Molly, but at last he removed the silver glasses. His eyes were a dark brown that matched the shade of his very short military-cut hair. He smiled.
It is better this way, yes? Else we make the tunnel infinity, mirror into mirror. You particularly, he said to her, must take care. In Turkey, there is disapproval of women who sport such modifications.
Molly bit one of the pastries in half.
It's my show, Jack, she said, her mouth full.
She chewed, swallowed, and licked her lips.
I know about you. Stool for the military, right?
Her hand slid lazily into the front of her jacket and came out with the Fletcher. Case hadn't known she had it.
Very easy, please, Trezibastian said, his white china thimble frozen centimeters from his lips.
She extended the gun.
Maybe you get the explosives, lots of them, or maybe you get a cancer. One dart, shitface. You won't feel it for months.
This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.